Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
It's another world, isn't it? There's so many different colours.
There's structure there and some live coral. There's a fair number of fish, especially these aquarium fish, sergeant majors, damsels and so on. Have a look-see.
The coastal waters of the Philippines archipelago are home to what is emerging as the world's most diverse and productive marine ecosystem, from countless fish and invertebrates to a host of reef-building coral animals. But this major marine habitat is listed as one of the most endangered in the world.
Here we have the highest concentration of species per unit area than any other place on Earth. And also we have the highest threats to the marine environment. It's the marine counterpart to the Amazon River Basin.
I'm Lynn Malcolm with our series Balancing Nature on ABC Radio National Science Show. Of the 25,000 square kilometres of coral reef in the Philippines, barely 1% remain pristine. How is it possible to protect this biodiversity hotspot from the pressures wrought by the coastal population of 35 million dependent on its fisheries for a living? And could new scientific tools halt the decline and even restore this diverse habitat?
Hi.
Hello. What are you selling here?
That is our national fish, ma'am. Milk fish, bangos in our dialect.
And this one with the yellow stripes?
Yeah, tadungan po siya.
How much?
This one is 70 per kilo and this one 60.
A typical Filipino market where the huge array of fish and crustaceans on sale hint at the richness of the coast that's home to over half of the world's shallow water species. And a new report suggests that it's the Philippines that may actually have the richest concentration of marine life on the entire planet. Kent Carpenter of America's Smithsonian Institute, who spent 30 years studying coastal waters in the Philippines, has digitally overlaid nearly 3,000 of the latest maps charting the distribution of marine species to create a bullseye pattern of its diversity throughout what's known as the Coral Triangle. His analysis reveals the central Philippines as the epicentre.
I call this the center of marine biodiversity. And the database is 2,983 species and includes everything from seaweeds all the way up to marine mammals. So it also includes invertebrates. It includes fishes for the most part, other things such as sea snakes and sea turtles. And in our study, we found a concentration of endemics. These are species that are only found in one small part of the world, such as deepwater sharks and endemic wrasses. The endemics actually are from a number of different marine groups.
And the range of marine life is incredible, just with the fish alone, from the blue-spotted angelfish to many varieties of catfish, all existing together. What is it about this region that has allowed it to support such diverse marine species?
It might be because there are also a concentration of different marine habitats, so seagrass beds and mangroves and corals, and also proximity to fairly extensive soft sediment bottoms as well. Indeed, one of the reasons to concentrate in this area and be particularly aware of marine conservation issues is because this place is not only unique because of the concentration of species, but it's unique also as habitats, as an environment that allows this many species to co-occur in one area.
Kent Carpenter's research into this marine hotspot has acted as a rallying cry for conservation efforts here, since at its very heart lies the busy Verde Passage, situated just south of Manila. Stretching for over 100 kilometres, it's in effect a corridor linking the Pacific and the South China Sea. I've joined Mags Quibbelen and Ricky Bio of Conservation International on a wharf where you are confronted by the oil tankers and vast number of fishing boats plying its waters.
The corridor is a multiple-use area. For example, here in Batangas Bay, lots of industries can be found. Shipping, that's the reality that we have to accept. And on the other side, the oil and gas industries.
And meanwhile, you have boats going out from here, with a few of them in front of us, taking scuba divers out to enjoy the rich biodiversity of the passage.
When you go down there, you'd still see a lot of things that are colorful, interesting, different organisms. Very good for macro photographers, and a lot of nudibranchs, crinoids. It's sort of an oasis in all the chaos.
And below the surface, it's the destructive fishing methods using dynamite and cyanide that are the greatest threats. Jesse de las Treyes, a former fisher and chairman of the Aquatic Resources Council in the province of Catalogan, has witnessed the impact of these illegal fishing practices that are still going on.
Aquarium fishers use liquid cyanide to stun fish for an easy catch, but it kills the corals. Meanwhile, dynamite fishing for food catches has been rampant because it was cheap to get dynamite material and it guaranteed a big catch. If blast fishermen saw a ton of fish, they'd plant as many as 3 beer bottles full of warmed-up ammonium nitrate with a wick. It completely destroys the corals, reducing whole reefs to rubble, sometimes leaving a crater 4 meters wide, and it ruins the circulation of the marine ecosystem. As a result of all that, there are fish species out there that haven't even been recorded that have now become extinct.
But law enforcement is an ongoing challenge. The extensive coastlines are hard to patrol. There's no integrated approach to coastal management, and many remain oblivious to the reef's vulnerability. So it often takes tenacious locals to assume the role as true protectors. Margie Celeste is an environmental activist in Bolinao on the northwest coast of Luzon Island. She's forging links between marine scientists and local government and aims to capture the hearts and minds of the fishing community.
I have a brother who was the former mayor. We tried to invite those illegal fishers in one of these areas in Bolinao to convince them not to do illegal fishing anymore. We tried to win them back, to go back to the traditional fishing. Then later on, there was a drunken one of those illegal fishers who came here and he even tried to throw a bomb here. But my brother was a tough guy. So the more that he tried to control this, and now it's better. But, you know, once in a while, there are still some of those fisher folks are hard-headed. And that dynamite fishing is really destroying the reef. So that's one of the threats as of now. So the community and the scientists, the marine scientists, and the local government are really trying to be partners to help each other so that we could really help to sustain the coral reef of Bolinao.
But for many, fishing in the Philippines is the employment of last resort. There are currently 3 times more fishermen than the coastal ecosystem can support. Al Licuanan heads the Shields Marine Biological Station in the busy Verde Passage and argues that destructive fishing practices are symptomatic of a larger issue.
If you're in a situation where there's too many of you and the resource is in short supply and you're put in a situation, for example, when big commercial fishing vessels operate too close to shore, then you're forced to use gears that are more efficient than the ones the big fishers use, and that's the use of explosives, the use of toxins. It's actually quite common to hear this point of view that if we don't get that fish, those big boats will.
So the solution isn't simply just to have really good enforcement. It's quite a complex set of solutions, isn't it? Can you outline some of the principles that are required to try and tackle this problem?
You have to find a way to provide for the livelihood of these people while encouraging them to catch less fish. So one solution involves reducing the number of fishers and increasing their income somehow. There has to be other sources of livelihood, and the better options with regards to that are the ones that still involve taking care of the resource base. Okay, so you want to put in livelihood that requires them to help take care of the sea.
And at a hatchery at the Marine Science Institute in Bolinao, researchers are pioneering new income opportunities for the fishing community.
This is where we spawn the cucumbers. raise the juveniles, and then at a certain size, you take them out to the wild.
They're developing ways of breeding the ecologically important sea cucumbers to return to the ocean, since overfishing has depleted the stocks. These so-called earthworms of the sea are some of the highest valued invertebrates in the Philippines, fetching good prices in Chinese restaurants. Annette Menez from the Marine Science Institute sees huge potential in educating local fishers to manage their own sea cucumber industry.
So we're working with groups of fishers with this project to release juveniles that are reared in the hatchery such that they will grow to premium grade sizes. In this way, we can optimize the value that they can get from the sea cucumbers. It also benefits ecologically because then the animals would have been able to reproduce before they're harvested many times. So the idea is they don't need to harvest too many animals to be able to get the price that's needed for, you know, a decent source of income.
So your long-term goal is really saving the biodiversity of the creatures, but also providing economic benefit to create a sustainable product.
Any resource that is linked to livelihood, automatically you deal with both the ecological and the socioeconomic. And so what we hope is that this is an initial intervention, but if the system is put in place, then probably as the natural fishery recovers, then it can be a sustainable livelihood. So what we're doing is developing technologies to improve the management of invertebrate fisheries on the one hand, and at the same time ensuring that there will be benefits to the small fishers particularly.
Okay, we go.
And it's not just reefs which form important habitats for supporting biodiversity and economic potential. I'm en route to the largest and most diverse area of seagrass in the Philippines. Seagrass is a critical nursery for many fish and invertebrates, and fast becoming acknowledged as an important transition zone between corals and mangroves for many species as they move between habitats during their lifespans. Mike Fortes, an ecologist at the Marine Science Institute, has negotiated a protected reserve a few kilometres off the coast of Bolinao to carry out the first detailed study on the variety of marine life that seagrass can support.
We are now in the reserve. It's a 60-hectare reserve with 40 hectares buffer zone and 20 hectares core zone. And these are delineated by these nice orange buoys. We are getting really a lot of species. We're trying to show the people what they have, that really seagrasses are a home, a nursery, or a spawning ground of especially what they consider as the economically important ones. Those which directly they can eat, or those they sell in markets. And I'm seeing very nice changes, especially in the flora and the fauna.
How difficult has it been to keep this as a reserve? Any pressure from the local communities?
We are still in that process. But the ordinance states that it has to be protected. No, especially in the core zone, as defined, there's no fishing there. That is the reason why we have to go back to the barangays of the communities, because we have to tell them what should not be done, what should be done, who should do it, and getting their help.
By controlling the fishing access here, Mike Fortes aims to show the biodiversity that flourishes and the speed with which it multiplies in a protected habitat.
The intricacies, once you start looking at it with different eyes, is really quite different to the sort of snorkeling that you do in coral areas. There are some really lovely subtleties.
And then you go down, you will meet sea cucumbers, even brittle stars, by the way, crabs, gastropods, mollusks, you name it, they are all there. And we're very excited about it because in the Philippines, this is the first time that such an intensive study has been done here. First, we make the people aware of what seagrasses are. Then, that protecting the seagrass can actually improve their means, their income.
You're listening to Balancing Nature on ABC Radio National Science Show with me, Lynn Malcolm. What's known as marine protected areas are seen as the most effective way forward for conservation and fisheries management. They are sites where habitats can recover from years of destructive fishing, and growing fish stocks can in effect seed fishing waters outside the area. The Philippines has 1,000 of these reserves, but many are poorly managed or too small to be effective. Andre Uchiaco of the Marine Science Institute is advising many communities on how they can properly establish and maintain their own reserve.
Seemingly, it's a paradox, like, if you have bigger protected areas, then you'll have less fishing grounds, you'll get less fish. But actually, the problem is that the fisheries is really eating into the breeding stocks. So basically, by protecting the breeding stocks, you actually will have higher yield by having lesser fishing ground.
But with a growing awareness of the value of these reserves, locals are all too eager to cooperate. Fishermen are taking on roles as day-to-day managers and learning ways to assess and quantify the effectiveness of a reserve.
For example, counting fish, we tell them basically all you need is this very long tape measure, if you will. And we would mark the tape measure every 5 meters with black tape. That gives you like a long strip rectangle. So you just count the various types of fish there and group them by like size classes. I mean, they know the fishes very well, of course, so that's really no problem to them. They're very comfortable in the water. And they actually do it many times much better than, like, let's say, a local government fishery technician would, because, you know, it's their job. The key thing also is not to stop there, but to show them how to summarize and process the data and come up with a picture of what's happening. And you can see, like, trends for each major type of fish, which is of importance to them, like the food fishes that they catch. And we incorporate, you know, some of the scientific concepts in terms of like replication, representative sampling sites, and so on like that. And they pick up the ideas and just go with it.
But it's not just a token gesture in community participation. Fishers are also taking on the tougher role of patrolling their protected waters. Rodrigo Diaz leads the Sea-Watch team, known as Bantay Dagat, which supports the local authorities in apprehending up to 300 blast fishes per month in the Verde Corridor. The job is not without its risks, since his predecessor, Captain Atienza, was gunned down at a village fiesta back in 2003, following a series of death threats from illegal fishermen.
I told our members that if we didn't continue the Bantay Dagat, we would have wasted the life of Atienza, and it would all have been for nothing. So it made us more aggressive and determined to continue his work.
How do you go about deterring illegal fishing now? How big a job is it?
It's a large area, and we divide into 6 groups. All are trained in search and boarding, and procedures for arresting and intelligence gathering. We've linked up with the national police, who are on standby when we make an arrest. I'd say it's been 80% effective as far as enforcement goes, and it's serving as a model for other municipalities.
And the ecological success stories are beginning to emerge. Ed Gomez, former director of the Marine Science Institute, has been surveying reefs throughout the Philippines over the last 30 years. And at Apo, a 34-kilometre reef west of Mindoro Island, drained of life by heavy and destructive fishing, he's seen one of the first properly managed marine reserves generate a big increase in both fish yields and biodiversity.
When I dived there in the early 80s, I was aghast because most of the reefs there were essentially dead and there was very little evidence of fish life. And I did not go back there for about 2 decades. And when I got underwater, I could not believe my eyes that the reefs were back. As a matter of fact, it was the first time I saw close hand what is referred to as a wall of shacks. These are Karangids that were swimming in schools back and forth along the reef. So some things can turn around to a point where they become productive.
Ed Gomez is aiming to speed up the recovery of reefs still further with artificial restoration, transplanting living corals to dead or dying reefs. His team is steadily getting to grips with the many factors affecting coral growth, where the best sites are to transplant corals, and what kinds of species can be transferred without damaging the donor corals. His research partner, Helen Yap, took me to one of several experimental sites off the coast of Bolinau.
Oh, Helen, we've just come up and looked at the experimental site where you are assessing the transplants of the coral both vertically and horizontally.
It's an attempt to see if it's possible to bring these colonies of coral back to life by seeding them with a critical number of transplants of a certain size and a certain combination of species, and to see if that formula will work to initiate the development of a new thriving community.
And we saw some very healthy looking corals growing, didn't we?
Yes.
Like a yellowy green, almost like a cauliflower.
So that's the species Parietes cylindrica, and it is healthy. They were rather small when they were first transplanted, that is more than a year ago, and they've grown quite well. They're quite well adapted to this kind of environment.
And what are you finding from this site about whether the transplants are taking better horizontally or vertically?
That's a very good question. It is critical what is the aspect, whether it's horizontal or vertical, because that has to do with how much light intensity they get and even how much sediment will actually settle on them. If they're on the horizontal surface, they get a lot of light and they get a lot of sediment settling on them as well. On the vertical surfaces, they kind of avoid those stresses. So some species will grow much better on the vertical rather than on the horizontal for those reasons.
So there seems to be so many different factors affecting the transplant of a coral. It must be quite overwhelming.
It is. It is for us and for the coral as well. And so it's a real challenge for scientists to determine what combinations of factors in nature are best to ensure the best possible survival and growth and eventually reproduction of the coral.
We're talking about scales of kilometers, if not hundreds of kilometers. So sooner or later, we have to involve the communities in the actual process of rehabilitation of their reefs. If we can help identify the correct spots where restoration might be most effective, if we can have enough communities to start up a few healthy spots of coral growth, then that might accelerate the process of natural recovery.
And to be effective in the long term, they'll need to be as resilient as possible to the predicted rises in sea temperature linked to future climate change. Bleaching is a coral stress response to ocean warming. Corals literally turn white and the whole ecosystem collapses. It's already posing a threat to many reefs. But in his coral transplant experiments during the warming that occurred after the last El Niño event in 1998, Ed Gomez found that some corals may be more tolerant of warming than was once thought.
The corals were growing very, very well, and there was already a large community of fish until the bleaching event took place, when many of the corals that we had transplanted died. Only one species, Pavona frondifera, did not bleach, whereas the other 10 bleached. But now, because there's some structure there and some live coral, there's a fair number of fish still. Especially these aquarium fish, sergeant majors, damsels, and so on.
So what potential do you think that this knowledge that you're gaining about some corals perhaps being a bit more resistant to bleaching, what potential does that have for perhaps mitigating some of the effects that we might be going to see with climate change?
Well, what we think we might have to do in some situations is transplant some of these resistant or resilient species and hope that they can bring back the reef faster than natural processes. We'll start with a less diverse community, but we hope that in time other species can come in and produce a very diverse reef again.
With its vast coastal population dependent on fish, the threats to the coral reefs of the Philippines is greater than to any other reef in the world. According to Ed Gomez, the future of this epicentre of marine biodiversity, as both a sustainable economic resource and as a repository for unique species, will ultimately depend on increasing the public awareness of the value and vulnerability of their unique marine environment.
While some of the issues are global in nature, there has to be some action at the local scale. Now, one of these is just to reduce the stress, the local stress, on the reefs, because we believe that a reef that is not being stressed by pollution, by blast fishing, and other anthropogenic insults can probably be more resilient if it's faced with, warmer temperatures or higher light intensity. But if you add both the anthropogenic to the natural stressors, then you have a very bleak prognosis for your patient.
Clearly, the continued close interplay between scientists, local government, and the community will be vital. But at its heart comes the realization that conserving biodiversity and maintaining a livelihood doesn't have to be mutually exclusive.
The recent developments for the past 2 years, that it being a center and then, you know, the emphasis on network of protected areas, have really pulled people together to actually do things. I mean, we're also starting to innovate, you know, not really put things in boxes, but think more out of the box. And people just coming together and really talking about it is a big thing for us.
Next week, in the final part of Balancing Nature, I'll be in New Zealand, the land of the long white cloud, where the country's biodiversity has been decimated by invasive mammals. Can a pioneering experiment to rid the land of its pests restore its natural balance of plants and animals? Join me then.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.